Well, ladies and gentlemen, good morning to all of you, and welcome to this morning's discussion and for the EBA seminar on double dividends of climate aid, an effective way forward, which is organized, arranged by EBA, the expert group for aid analysis and studies. We're very pleased to see so many of you here today, considering that it's Easter week, early Monday morning, maybe not so early, but anyway, Monday morning. So we look forward to having a good and interesting seminar with all of you and fruitful discussions. My name is Kim Fors, and I'm a member of the committee of the expert group. Today I will be moderating this discussion from now and up to 12 o'clock. Let me say a few words about EBA for those of you who are not familiar with us from before. The Expert Group for Aid Committee was set up around 3 years ago. We're now in our third year of operations. And it's the government's committee for aid analysis and evaluation. The emphasis both on policy studies, research, evidence generation around aid, and evaluation to inform policy discussions and to inform practical work in the aid agencies as well. We have been prolonged recently, so we will be operating through 2018. The committee consists of 10 persons. The chair is Lars Heikensten of the Nobel Foundation, and the vice chair is Gun-Britt Andersson, who was previously Secretary of State in the Ministry for Foreign Affairs. And then we are 8 other members from different walks in life, the academy, consultants from the public service in various capacities. We have a secretariat with 7 people employed. And of course, our business is to initiate studies, and then those studies are undertaken by independent researchers, consultants. And we like to say that we work on the principle of double independence, meaning that we are independent from the government. We initiate the studies that we see fit and of interest, and our authors are independent of us. So we are not in any way, so to say, screening their conclusions or so. We do have a role in quality assurance, of course, but basically the reports that we publish are the authors' reports, and we like to emphasize the principle of ownership for the studies we do. Yes, today we have the pleasure of announcing the new EBA report on In Search of Double Dividends from Climate Change Interventions, Evidence from Two Sectors, Forestry Conservation and Household Energy Transitions. And this is the ninth report of 2015, and we have in total published around 15 reports so far, and we have another 20 in the pipeline. So there is a considerable amount of evidence coming out of our group. The studies are of quite different kinds. Some of them are organizational studies, like we have an evaluation organizational study of the African Development Bank. We are in the process of doing a study of the Swedfund. But we also have studies focusing on particular countries. So we have one study ongoing on the impact of 50 years of development cooperation with Tanzania. And we have another study on development cooperation with Uganda. And then we have two synthesis studies of education of aid to the education sector. They will be launched within a couple of months' time. And we have had studies of human rights and the business sector and many other fields, of course. Just to point a little bit to the diversity of what we are doing. But today it's climate change interventions, and it's two sectors. The background is, of course, that climate change interventions have been prioritized in Swedish development cooperation for a long time, and the allocations to the sector has been growing internationally. It's a growing area of aid, very important in the portfolio of many other donor agencies. So the question of what is Sweden doing in this field, and what do we know about the effectiveness and impact of interventions is an important one. In the in the process of initiating those this study, we have not only looked then at the question of what do we know about the impact of interventions in this field, but we are also looking at what can one know, what can evaluation and our studies contribute with, and what is the status of knowledge in this field? Is there trustworthy evidence? To what extent is there trustworthy evidence? And if not so, what can be done about it? Within this fairly short study, there are several approaches taken to climate aid, and there are a few different questions that the authors address in it. Today's seminar is, the idea is that we present the report, or rather the authors present the report, and then we'll have a discussion around it, and the emphasis is on the discussion from different perspectives. We have guests from Norway and from the UK who will talk about their approach to climate change interventions. And we have also people from both SIDA and the Ministry for Foreign Affairs who will comment on the study. Our program is as follows. After my welcome and introduction here, we'll turn to climate finance and climate aid, what is needed after COP21. There, Mark Storey from the Ministry of Finance will introduce the subject, and after that, the authors will present the report. And then after that, our guest from Norway, Ivar Jørgensen, will give a Norwegian view on the study and comment on it. Then we have a long coffee break for all of you to recuperate after this, let's say, rather massive start, and also to network a little bit and exchange comments on the report, all these things that you do in coffee breaks. And then after that, we turn to the to a panel discussion. And for that panel discussion, we have guests from DFID and Alison Pollard, who was also in the reference group for the study this year. Anders Granlund from SIDA will take part. Ivar Jørgensen, again from NORAD, will also take part. And Marcus Wallberg from the Ministry for Foreign Affairs, from the Multilateral Department. That's also the point when we will have open for debate and questions from you in the audience. So stay until after the coffee break, and then you can ask questions and engage in a wider debate. Well, you don't have to ask questions. You can also say things that are not exactly questions. I know that many people have a lot of views on the subject. And then we'll conclude by 12 o'clock. So that's today's program. So let's now turn to the first issue here. And though the focus is on the report as such and what we know about evidence and what we know about impact, the starting point is, of course, the need for development cooperation in this field and the need for aid. What kind of financial flows are expected and are needed, and what have the negotiations around climate aid have to say in this field? So here I would like to welcome Mark Storey to introduce that subject to us. And Mark is Deputy Director at the Ministry of Finance and has considerable experience from the climate negotiation process and with climate finance in particular, and is a member of the Swedish climate delegation. And he was also appointed by the COP presidency to co-facilitate the negotiations on the issue of long-term finance. So, welcome, Mark. We look forward to hearing what you have to say.
Good morning, all. I apologise if my throat's a bit... if I'm going to clear my throat sometimes during the presentation. I got this flu bug over the weekend. Good morning. I understand the context of this presentation is to set the scene somewhat for this discussion on climate aid and climate finance, and just to look at what's been ongoing in the climate negotiations under the UN, both prior to the Paris conference last December, what the tone of the discussion was, what's happened in Paris, both since before and after. And I had a little look on the Google on the Friday afternoon for some nice pictures of climate finance. I quite like this one. It's kind of the inverse of money growing on trees, but trees growing out of money. And there were quite a few interesting pictures which kind of capture this context of climate finance. But moving on to how the discussion's been going, the UN Climate Convention was signed in 1992, and what that did, over and above the overarching goals on the need to reduce emissions, in terms of finance, was that it established obligations on developed country parties, and here a very specific set of developed country parties. They were listed in Annex 2 to provide financial resources to developing country parties to meet their needs. And the list of parties with these obligations was very specific. It's listed in an annex. It's basically the OECD countries in Annex 2. And the focus at that time initially was very much on public finance. The nature of the obligations, there were no quantified obligations initially, and the nature of the obligations were also fairly broad. It was basically to assist developing countries in meeting their needs and fulfilling their obligations that they had in the convention. And then perhaps the next major breakpoint, besides the history around the Kyoto Protocol, etc., was in the climate finance world, was the meeting in Copenhagen in 2009, that famous meeting where Sweden had the EU presidency. And even though listed, seen as a failure by many, it was actually a fairly groundbreaking meeting in many regards, and to some extent certainly set the scene for Paris. You could say what we didn't finish in Copenhagen, we finished in a different way in Paris, even though Paris certainly doesn't mean finished business, but it was completing a cycle. And what happened in Copenhagen, although not actually formally not approved until the meeting in the COP in Cancun 1 year later, was an obligation for the first time, a quantified obligation on developed country parties rather than Annex 2, but saying developed, to mobilise up to $100 billion per year by 2020. And this underlying word mobilise, as opposed to the previous word provision, is the key word here, because mobilisation basically meant it's not just public money, but it was quite clear that parties would act to mobilise resources from both the public and the private sector. And also it talked about alternative sources, such as potential levies on the transport sector, and in particular aviation emissions at the time. So that was the first major shift, and also this wording developed country parties, so it was a little bit more vague, it was a little bit more self-selecting who sees themselves as developed in this context. And then a number of other major issues that came out of Copenhagen in relation to transparency, but in terms of the climate finance discussion, it was at Copenhagen that it was effectively agreed that we needed a new multilateral specific climate fund. And it was agreed to establish the Green Climate Fund. It took a few years after the Copenhagen meeting before it got up and running. And at the same time, the Standing Committee on Finance, which I have had pleasure of sitting on for the last couple of years, which is the Standing Committee on Finance was set up as a sort of an oversight body to have an oversight over climate financial flows. It was particularly requested by developing countries, I think. As is highlighted in the report, the EBA report, there's a lot of fragmentation on climate finance, a lot of definitional issues, and the context around the Standing Committee was we would have a body which would have some oversight and give recommendations to the COP. What happened at COP21, Paris? In the last few days, there was quite a lot of late nights, some sleeping, but hopefully quite a lot of alertness from many of us. On the last day, on the Saturday after 2 weeks, the presidency gavelled through a decision, and as you know, to widespread international acclaim. And it was, even though it's the beginning of, in many ways, it's not the end of, the Paris Agreement. To some extent, gives us a lot yet to do. But it was the closure of a cycle, which I would say effectively we initially tried to close in Copenhagen in 2015. We now have a new international agreement. Focusing mostly on the climate aspects, because the most notable part of the Paris Agreement is for the first time ever you have all parties undertaking their own nationally determined contributions. So they determine their own level of ambition, but they announce this level of ambition, and it's subject to some degree of international scrutiny, and there will be review periods built into the Paris Agreement which see that all parties will seek to raise their ambition over time. So it was quite different from what happened with the Kyoto Protocol, which was more of a top-down model. This was effectively parties themselves identifying where their ambition should lie. In relation to the finance part of it, the finance part was a key part. You had the mitigation objectives, you had wording on adaptation, you had wording on loss and important part, wording on loss and damage. On the issue of finance and means of implementation, the most important parts of Paris, probably from our perspective, was this initial transformative goal. It ensures that all parties have responsibility to ensure their investment flows are consistent with a pathway towards low greenhouse gas emissions and climate resilient development. And the reason that's so was pushed for from the EU and many other parties was that the climate agreement can't just be about money. We can't just be measuring money that's going to climate related expenditure if at the same time we're pushing trillions of dollars towards maladaptive energy and other sorts of investments which are actually worsening the problem. So for the first time there was a responsibility on all parties to at least look at the fact that all their investment flows that are effectively being triggered by public decision making are consistent on this pathway approach. It also reiterated that clearly developed countries shall provide financial resources. For the first time, developing countries are encouraged to. We from the EU would have preferred something a little bit stronger in terms of the spread between the responsibilities for developed and developing, maybe a little bit more than are encouraged to. But it was compared to what was prior to Paris, a fairly important move in terms of this differentiation of responsibility. And clearly it was also the EU's intention that developed country parties should have the lead responsibility. But this getting the critical wording around the role of developing countries also was important. And that's specifically in terms of providing financial resources. The next point is about mobilising support, which is a little bit broader. It's looking at the role of the private sector and what developed country parties and developing can be doing to mobilise support from the private sector towards climate investments. And here it's clearly that developed country parties again will take the lead, but the wording does also open up a role for developing country parties here as well. There was quite a lot of focus on adaptation financing in Paris, and this critical wording, which is there's going to be quite a lot of discussion around how we fulfil this, but this aim to achieve a balance in the provision of resources for mitigation and adaptation. And there was an early wording which was seeking a sort of a 50-50 balance. We, for various reasons, moved away from that and just worked on a little bit more of a qualitative objective, say, well, we need to get a more appropriate balance between adaptation and financing for mitigation and for adaptation purposes. There are some quite specific wording in the agreement about the need to significantly increase adaptation finance from current levels. And the other thing in the overall agreement, not in the actual Paris Agreement, but in some of the accompanying decisions, was this $100 billion commitment for developed country parties was effectively extended out from 2020 to 2025 as a floor. So instead of a roof, it's now a minimum level. And so developed country parties undertook to once again have a specific quantified goal which applies to them, but that will be reviewed after 2025. And I would expect at 2025 there would be some pressure on, if there is to be another quantified goal, that there would be more, it would be broadened beyond the scope of just developed country parties only. Sweden's role briefly is Sweden is a major donor in multilateral climate funds. It's the biggest per capita donor to the Green Climate Fund. And it also the Global Environmental Facility and the Adaptation Fund. Sweden provides extensive bilateral support, and for a number of years have been working a climate change perspective mainstreamed in all bilateral development cooperation. And as well as that, we made some additional announcements in the run-up to COP21. Challenges ahead. As is outlined here, that public finance and development finance will continue to play a key role, but everyone accepts the fact that more private finance is needed. This raises a question around whether we should be, when talking development assistance, whether there's a need for some shifts or greater shifts from traditional providing finance in the form of traditional grants to the use of instruments that can catalyse private investment flows. A lot's happening here. It's not entirely, and the question is more needed. As is highlighted in the report, using ODA to address climate-related goals can result in double dividends, but I guess importantly there are some, when you have double goals or more than one goal, that can result in some conflict between those goals, and the question is how to prioritise and best address and to measure effectiveness in that context. Transparency is a continued key issue. I'll come back and finish with a couple of slides just to show how complex the climate finance landscape is. But we, to be able to go forward and to build trust and have all parties involved, we need to be able to measure what finance, how much, to whom, and importantly, with what results. The EBA report, I noted, talked quite a lot about the complex finance landscape. This was done initially by CPI, and then I think adapted a little bit by Bruegel, this particular slide. I haven't cited it correctly. But the point is here, up the top in the blue, you have government budgetary climate finance. And then as you move down to the bottom, you sort of have the other investors, private sector investors. So when Climate Policy Initiative do an overview of tracking of climate finance delivered, it's a very complex structure coming from some of the public, the more traditional public donors, development finance institutes, the bilateral funds, etc., and you come down to the private sector down the bottom. And if you inverse this from a recipient country's perspective, I've seen one for Indonesia, it's equally complex, the number of financial flows into Indonesia from the different sources of financing. And this diagram, it's a little bit hard to read. This was done by the Standing Committee, and this was the overview of biennial assessment of climate financial flows. Basically, the ones down the bottom, the 1.2 billion, this was 2012 figures. That is the UNFCCC climate funds, which at the time was largely the GEF. The GCF wasn't in the picture at that time. Then you have the other multilateral climate funds above that, 3.4 billion. And then you move out towards flows from, there's flows to developing countries through public institutions, which was 35 to 50 billion. And then you have the big envelope. We call this the onion diagram at the top. When you measure overall financial flows, it's big numbers. But a lot of the discussion in the UN is which part of this onion is climate finance. When we report against these, when we have these obligations, which part of this do we count? And that's the accountability discussion, which is still somewhat of an open question. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mark. That's really interesting. And I think that onion you have up there is really a challenge to consider and to think about. It reminds me of the scene in Ibsen's play, Peer Gynt, where Peer Gynt is looking for the truth about life, and he's peeling the onion to find the kernel, and there is no kernel. Let's hope that there is a kernel in this onion that you have here.